good horse, I call you my shiny black bears. To the playhouse of fortune, to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else. And this we go riding.
You're listening to episode 570 of Unwelcome Guests, The Fundamental Wrongness of Rights. I'm Robin Upton. Now, that title is intended to bring out the contradiction that I see as fundamental in law in its modern form. The subtitle, Law as Fiction, similarly highlights the arbitrary and fictitious nature of modern law, which has long since transcended its origins as a formal codification of what people did. It's now what a few people at the top of a social hierarchy would like the rest of humanity to do, and oftentimes they don't even follow it themselves. We have a range of speakers this week from a range of perspectives. Now, to get the ball rolling, I thought we'd start with George Carlin. This is a slightly expurgated, FCC-safe version of a few minutes of his on rights and the fundamental contradictions therein.
Here's one more item for you, the last in our civics book, rights. Boy, everyone in this country is always running around yammering about their rights. I have a right, you have no right, we have a right, they don't have a right. Folks, I hate to spoil your fun, but there's no such thing as rights, okay? They're imaginary. We made them up, like the boogeyman. The Three Little Pigs, Pinocchio, Mother Goose. Rights are an idea. They're just imaginary. They're a cute idea. Cute. But that's all. Cute and fictional. But if you think you do have rights, let me ask you this. Where do they come from? People say, well, they come from God. They're God-given rights. Here we go again. The God excuse. The last refuge of a man with no answers and no argument. It came from God. Anything we can't describe must have come from God. Personally, folks, I believe that if your rights came from God, he would have given you the right to some food every day, and he would have given you the right to a roof over your head. God would have been looking out for you. God would have been looking out for you. You know that? He wouldn't have been worried about making sure you have a gun so you get drunk on Sunday night and kill your girlfriend's parents. But let's say it's true. Let's say God gave us these rights. Why would he give us a certain number of rights? The Bill of Rights of this country has 10 stipulations, okay? 10 rights. And apparently God was doing sloppy work that week because we've had to amend the Bill of Rights an additional 17 times. So God forgot a couple of things, like slavery. Just f***ing slipped his mind. But let's say God gave us the original 10. He gave the British 13. The British Bill of Rights has 13 stipulations. The Germans have 29. The Belgians have 25. The Swedish have only 6. And some people in the world have no rights at all. What kind of a f***ing goddamn God-given deal is that? No rights at all? Why would God give different people in different countries different numbers of different rights? Boredom? Amusement? Bad arithmetic? Do we find out at long last, after all this time, that God is weak in math skills? Doesn't sound like divine planning to me. Sounds more like human planning. Sounds more like one group trying to control another group. In other words, business as usual in America. Now, if you think you do have rights, one last assignment for you. Next time you're at the computer, get on the internet, go to Wikipedia. When you get to Wikipedia, in the search field for Wikipedia, I want you to type in Japanese Americans 1942, and you'll find out all about your precious rights, okay? All right. You know about it. You know about it. In 1942, there were 110,000 Japanese-American citizens in good-standing, law-abiding people who were thrown into internment camps simply because their parents were born in the wrong country. That's all they did wrong. They had no right to a lawyer, no right to a fair trial, no right to a jury of their peers, no right to due process of any kind. The only right they had, right this way, into the internment camps. Just when these American citizens needed their rights the most, their government took them away. And rights aren't rights if someone can take them away. They're privileges. That's all we've ever had in this country is a bill of temporary privileges. And if you read the news even badly, you know that every year the list gets shorter and shorter and shorter. You see how soon? Yeah. Sooner or later, the people in this country are going to realize the government does not give a fuck about them. Government doesn't care about you or your children or your rights or your welfare or your safety. It simply doesn't give a fuck about you. It's interested in its own power. That's the only thing, keeping it and expanding it wherever possible. Personally, when it comes to rights, I think one of two things is true. I think either we have unlimited rights or we have no rights at all. Personally, I lean toward unlimited rights. I feel, for instance, I have the right to do anything I please. But if I do something you don't like, I think you have the right to kill me. So where are you going to find a fairer deal than that? So the next time some asshole says to you, I have a right to my opinion, you say, oh yeah, well, I have a right to my opinion, and my opinion is you have no right to your opinion. Then shoot the fuck and walk away. Thank you.
Well, thanks to George Carlin for highlighting the arbitrariness of rights as doled out by governments. Even if the whole world could agree on one sacred text, these are our rights, then I don't think we've solved the problem, because the ambiguity comes in their interpretation to the situations. So it doesn't seem to me that a one world government solution with a long list of laws and what should be done, what shouldn't be done, is necessarily the answer. But that's the way that developments seem to be going, with harmonization, watch out for that word, of legal regimes, usually means picking the lowest common denominator as far as whoever is doing the choosing is concerned. So if business interests are harmonizing environmental regulations, they tend to say, all right, well, everybody can use this country's laws where that country's been chosen for having the least restrictive laws as far as business is concerned. So, certainly the case that legal jurisdictions have been increasing, European-wide laws are being introduced, and that the amount of law on the books has been skyrocketing. Some of the personal consequences of that will now be told by Philip K. Howard, who's an American lawyer and writer aiming to reform the American legal system and governmental system. And this is the beginning half of his talk given at the TED conference in 2010.
I've always been interested in the relationship of formal structures and human behavior. If you build a wide road out to the outskirts of town, people will move there. Well, law is also a powerful driver of human behavior. And what I'd like to discuss today is the need to overhaul and simplify the law to release the energy and passion of Americans so that we can begin to address the challenges of our society. You might have noticed that law has grown progressively denser in your lives over the last decade or two. If you run a business, it's hard to do much of anything without calling your general counsel. Indeed, there's this phenomenon now where the general counsels are becoming the CEOs. It's a little bit like the invasion of the body snatchers. You need a lawyer to run the company because there's so much law. But it's not just business that's affected by this. It's actually pressed down into the daily activities of ordinary people. A couple of years ago, I was hiking near Cody, Wyoming. It was in a grizzly bear preserve, although no one told me that before we went. And our guide was a local science teacher. She was wholly unconcerned about the bears, but she was terrified of lawyers. The story started pouring out. She'd just been involved in an episode where a parent had threatened to sue the school because she lowered the grade of the student by 10% because he turned the paper in late. The principal didn't want to stand up to the parent because he didn't want to get dragged into some legal proceedings. So she had to go to the meeting after meeting, same arguments made over and over again. After 30 days of sleepless nights, she finally capitulated. and raised the grade. She said, life's too short. I just can't keep going with this. About the same time, she was going to take two students to a leadership conference in Laramie, which is a couple of hours away, and she was going to drive them in her car. But the school said, no, you can't drive them in the car for liability reasons. You have to go in a school bus. So they provided a bus that held 60 people and drove them, the three of them, back and forth several hours to Laramie. Her husband was also a science teacher, and he takes his biology class on a hike in the nearby national park. But he was told he couldn't go on the hike this year because one of the students in the class was disabled, so the other 25 students didn't get to go on the hike either. At the end of this day, I could have filled a book just with stories about law from this one teacher. Now, we've been taught to believe that law is the foundation of freedom, but somehow or another in the last couple of decades, the land of the free has become a legal minefield. It's really changed our lives in ways that are sort of imperceptible, and yet when you pull back, you see it all the time. It's changed the way we talk. I was talking to a pediatrician friend in North Carolina. He said, well, you know, I don't deal with patients the same way anymore. You wouldn't want to say something off the cuff that might be used against you. This is a doctor whose life is caring for people. My own law firm has a list of questions that I'm not allowed to ask when interviewing candidates, such as the sinister question, bulging with hidden motives and innuendo, where are you from? Now, for 20 years, tort reformers have been sounding the alarm that lawsuits are out of control, and we read, you know, every once in a while about these crazy lawsuits, like the guy in the District of Columbia who sued his dry cleaners for $54 million because he lost his pair of pants. The case went on for 2 years. I think he's still appealing the case. But the reality is these crazy cases are relatively rare. They don't usually win. And the total of direct tort costs in this country is about 2%, which is twice as much as in other countries, but as taxes go, hardly crippling. But the direct costs are really only the tip of the iceberg. What's happened here, again, almost without our knowing, is our culture has changed. People no longer feel free to act on their best judgment. So what do we do about it? We certainly don't want to give up the rights when people do something wrong to seek redress in the courts. We need regulation to make sure people don't pollute and such. We lack even a vocabulary to deal with this problem. And that's because we have the wrong frame of reference. We've been trained to think that the way to look at every dispute, every issue, is a matter of kind of individual rights. And so we peer through a legal microscope and look at everything. Is it possible that there were extenuating circumstances that explain why Johnny turned his paper in late in Cody, Wyoming? Is it possible that the doctor might have done something differently when the sick person gets sicker? And of course, the hindsight bias is perfect. There's always a different scenario that you can sketch out where it's possible that something could have been done differently. And yet we've been trained to squint into this legal microscope, hoping that we can judge any dispute against the standard of a perfect society where everyone will agree what's fair and where accidents will be extinct, risk will be no more. Of course, this is utopia. It's a formula for paralysis, not freedom. It's not the basis of the rule of law. It's not the basis of a free society.
Now, I've cut the second half of that because his solutions, I think, for how to go about overhauling law are less useful to us than his highlighting of the problem. You know, you may be thinking, if you're a regular listener particularly, back to Charles Eisenstein's Center for Humanity. Well, we're going to hear a chapter of that in just a minute called Life Under Contract, about the increasing codification, increasing rulemaking about every aspect of human behavior. Charles Eisenstein talks about changing social, natural capital into money. Now, I'm not completely happy with that as a phrase because, I mean, money is a fiction and that's not actually what's happening. Now, I draw a parallel with biological evolution where some adaptations mean that species survive and reproduce more than others. I would look at the changes to the legal social environment under a selection pressure that is capitalism, so that laws which cause increasing amounts of money to flow to those who made those laws are positively selected for, and laws which have the reverse effect are negatively selected for. I think this can explain how manifold the different ways in which the outcome of this increasing codification is to make life more expensive, to demand more and more from most of humanity, feeding up the profits, that is, passing the control to the very few who control the show. I think Charles Eisenstein's analysis of the Newtonian worldview, the world as machine, is a very insightful one, not least because the same metaphor is still applied to the economy. People talk about the levers of power as if the whole nation, the whole world of people doing independent economic interactions should somehow be controllable by a small elite at the top, who are actually never mentioned in commercially controlled media. There isn't a discussion about money creation and central banks. So now let's hear a replay. This is from show 472.
From The Ascent of Humanity by Charles Eisenstein. Life under contract. The tyranny of yes and no, the migration of life to a wholly domesticated realm, and the dwindling of the uncertain and undefined in favor of the expressly permitted and explicitly forbidden takes another form in laws, rules, and regulations. Here, the program of control manifests as a spreading legalism that infiltrates all aspects of modern life. In the ecological sphere, the shrinking of the wild is domestication, confinement, and the great indoors. In the personal sphere, it's the conquest of the child's spontaneity and creativity. In the social sphere, it is the codification of previously informal agreements, ethics, and mores. As legal scholar Paul Campos puts it, anyone who compares the legal domains of our society to those of the pre-modern state immediately becomes aware of a tremendous and ever-increasing contraction of formally unregulated social space. Close quote. Our dependence on authority to delimit the realm of the permissible projects onto the collective level as the urge to regulate, to medicalize, juridify, and police every act of labor or play. Thanks to our schooling, we are accustomed to being told what is allowed, accustomed to authority determining right and wrong, and accustomed to coercive enforcement of these distinctions. Implicit in a world under control is that if something goes wrong, it must be someone's fault. Someone must bear legal responsibility. Someone must be punished, and I should be compensated. And so, children in authoritarian institutions such as schools resolve disputes by telling on each other, going to teacher, the source of authority. In religion, the same tendency manifests in the idea of God as a referee who will reward the just, punish the wicked, and make everything fair in the end. In law, this attitude motivates the burgeoning realm of the regulated, the ever-increasing contraction of formally unregulated social space, and our endemic reliance on lawsuits to resolve disputes. The rule of law has become a necessity as other forms of social coordination have broken down with the dissolution of community. In olden times, informal social pressures were far more potent than they are today, because people depended on their neighbors to meet economic and social needs. The goodwill of the community was extremely important, and the consequences of social shunning severe. Today in America, there are few real communities to speak of, only neighborhoods, and the opinion of neighbors matters little. As long as I obey all the laws, who cares what the neighbors think? I'm safe from anything they might do. I don't need to buy things from them. I don't need them to watch out for my children. I don't use the things they make. I don't depend on them for recreation. The conversion of social capital into money means that just as with all the rest of life's necessities, we rely on remote strangers for dispute resolution. The local and personal has been replaced by the formal and remote. Suppose my son breaks my neighbor's window with a baseball. My neighbor asks me to pay for it. In the past, if I refused, the opinion of the whole neighborhood would turn against me. If I consistently behaved like that, I would find myself unable to get credit at the local grocer's, unable to receive emergency services from the local doctor, unable to get babysitting help when something happened. People depended on the favors and non-monetary reciprocation that we call neighborliness. In most places in America today, few of those mechanisms of social pressure still operate, and my neighbor has no choice but to sue me, resorting to the outright coercive force of a distant and impersonal authority. Impersonality is built into the very concept of law, which is supposed to be objective, rational, and impartial. Disputes are to be resolved not according to who knows who, not according to one's reputation in the community, not according to whom the judge likes, not according to emotional judgments of right and wrong, and not according to popular sentiment, but rather by the impartial application of legal reasoning. That disputes in general can and should be resolved according to logic and principle is a fundamental assumption springing from the Newtonian-Cartesian worldview and modeling itself after axiomatic mathematics. In formal mathematics, we start with basic axioms, the equivalent of a constitution, and reason from those, adding new axioms, legislation, as necessary where the old ones fail to prove or disprove a proposition, resolve a new type of dispute. At the zenith of the age of reason in the early 20th century, David Hilbert enunciated the final goal of mathematics, a complete set of axioms from which all mathematical truth could be deduced. Though Hilbert's program crumbled with the work of Gödel and Turing in the 1930s, in the realm of law, we seem to think that any failure to rationally resolve the disputes of our day can and should be addressed with yet more laws. The end result would be a Hilbertian complete set of principles by which the legality of any act could be determined through unassailable logic. Then the ambiguity of human interaction would be gone. We would have in human relationship the same certainty that physicists have sought for centuries in their quest for a complete universal law, a theory of everything, in which everything would be of well-defined legal standing. Every act would be either legal or illegal. Already we are so thoroughly conditioned to a world under control that I suspect many people would not see this as an alarming statement. It might even be hard to conceive of any other status, just as it is hard to conceive of a piece of land just existing without being owned. Someone has to own it. It can't just be there. We find it easy to understand. Everything is legal unless expressly prohibited, or everything is illegal unless explicitly permitted, but not that some things simply have no legal status. In any realm, the regime of control demands the elimination of uncontrolled variables, the domestication of the wild. In the realm of law, the wild is the unregulated social space, and the variables represent uncertainty. Law represents the social reification of the technological program, whose goal is, as Campos puts it, quote, the final elimination of risk itself. He goes on to interpret the urge to regulate, to medicalize, juridify, and police every act of labor or play as a contemporary byproduct of the need to deal with the loss of any broadly held belief regarding the point of human existence, close quote. Intuitively, Campos has come close to a central theme of this book, which is that the compulsion to control the world arises out of an alienation which has shorn life of any meaning except the maximization of comfort, safety, and pleasure. Except it is more than a need to deal with a loss of belief that generates the urge to control. Control, rather, is the inevitable logical conclusion of our beliefs themselves. Here's an amusing example of the legalistic program to eliminate uncertainty. Some years ago, I read that the student code at a certain college was amended to require that each new step in erotic foreplay be preceded by the explicit consent of both parties, as in, may I kiss you? Yes. May I caress your breast? Yes, and so forth. No doubt this rule was written to clarify certain situations in which sexual consent was ambiguous, as in, just because I kissed him doesn't mean I gave him permission to grope me, close quote. The solution, define consent with even more rules. Forget the absurdity of the whole thing for a moment and consider the fundamental assumption that a sufficiently minute set of rules can resolve all ambiguity. It's the technological program again. One can imagine a case where the meaning of explicit consent comes into question. Is a sigh of passion enough? Does reciprocation of a caress need prior consent? What about uh-huh instead of yes? Where does the sigh end and uh-huh begin? No doubt we could create even finer distinctions to resolve these ambiguities. But there would be still more ambiguities created by the very attempt to define them away. The parallel with mathematics is uncanny. Gödel demolished Hilbert's program by proving that given any consistent axiomatic system of sufficient complexity, there will be true sentences in the formal language of that system that are unprovable from the axioms. The true sentence, or its negation, could be added as a new axiom, but no matter how many are added, there will always be yet other true statements unprovable from the expanded set of axioms. Similarly, no matter how fine the distinctions of law, there will always be situations that are not logically resolvable from the law. We can add new axioms, new laws, finer distinction, but still, there would be logically irresolvable situations. Steeped as we are in the mindset of the technological program, the solution is nonetheless to always add on more laws, more regulations, in hopes of finally encompassing every possible situation within a legal framework, everything either expressly forbidden or explicitly permitted with no gray areas. The result is, as Campos puts it, the 100-page appellate court opinion, the 200-page, 500-footnote law review article, the 1,000-page statute, the 16,000-page set of administrative regulations. And yet, as the letter of the law swells in exactitude and scope, the spirit of the law withers away and its power to control human behavior diminishes. The extension of law into every corner of life is visible in the increasing pervasiveness of the contract. We enter into contracts all the time without even noticing it. Have you ever noticed fine print saying, quote, by purchasing this product, you agree, dot, 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 close quote. At Penn State, by enrolling in the university, the student is legally consenting to abide by the regulations of the voluminous student handbook, and by enrolling in my class is agreeing to the syllabus, which is accorded the status of a contract between the student and the university. A contract is a legal agreement, one that is real in the eyes of the law. Here is the culmination of the confusion between label and object that representational language invites. The reality of an agreement depends on being written down, while consent devolves into a signature. What counts in an agreement? Not the unspoken understanding, nor its social context, but only what is in black and white, words on a page. Of course, the seeming objectivity of a law or contract is an illusion, since the words interpretation and enforcement, indeed, still depend on these more human factors. Expanding legalism rises out of the dissolution of community. Equally, it contributes to it. By relying on outside authority to adjudicate and impose a solution, we are relieved of the necessity of working things out among ourselves. "You won't hear from me again. You'll hear from my lawyers." These were the last words a friend of mine heard from a business partner of many years. Another variation, tell it to the judge. Another consequence of social governance by lawsuit and threat of lawsuit is the further reduction of life into money that I discussed in Chapter 4. Damages are calculated in dollars, and it is through dollars that we redress the matters of betrayal of trust, negligence, pain and suffering, and all the other subjects of lawsuits. Generally speaking, when people bring a lawsuit, they are seeking money. What else can you sue for? Remorse, sympathy, admission of wrongdoing? When someone is financially compensated for a wrongful death or dismemberment, the underlying message is that money is the equal of life or limb. The technological program to make life safe, the conversion of life into money, and the perversion of the law converge into the realm of liability insurance. The very word insurance hints at the assumption that life can indeed be made secure, that the unsure can be made sure. One of the industry's own term for itself is, after all, risk management. The consequences of this assumption are far-reaching indeed. Have you ever wondered why all the fun playground equipment, really high swings, jungle gyms, and slides have disappeared? Liability. Why doesn't anyone allow skateboarding in their public areas? Liability. When the justification of safety is baldly absurd, liability serves in its place. For the last 20 or 30 years, deterrence has been the mainstay of our penal code and prison system. The assumption behind deterrence, implicit in the very definition of the word, is that without the penalties, people would commit the associated crimes. The law stands behind my innate depravity and your life, liberty, and property. Interestingly, this is what Thomas Hobbes was saying in that oft-quoted passage from Leviathan. It is instructive to read the whole paragraph. Quote, "Whatsoever, therefore, is consequent to a time of war, where every man is enemy to every man, the same consequent to the time wherein men live without other security than what their own strength and their own invention shall furnish them with all. In such condition, there is no place for industry, because the fruit thereof is uncertain, and consequently no culture of the earth, no navigation, nor use of the commodities that may be imported by sea, no commodious building, no instruments of moving and removing such things as require much force, no knowledge of the face of the earth, no account of time, no arts, no letters, no society, and, which is worst of all, continual fear and danger of violent death, and the life of man solitary, poor, nasty, brutish, and short." Close quote. Hobbes was not talking so much about a pre-technological state, but rather the human condition in the absence of government. Without government, he argued, there could be no commerce, no buildings, no creative achievement, because what would stop someone else from just seizing the fruits of another's labor? We would always live in fear of robbery and would therefore be unwilling to do anything productive. Hobbes is talking about the ungoverned state of being. Because it is based on the Hobbesian Calvinistic precept of the innate depravity of man, law rests on a coercive basis that seeks to make socially undesirable behavior no longer in a person's rational self-interest. Law is more than codified social agreements, as in, we all agree to stop at red lights. It also includes explicit penalties for breaking those agreements. This is not just true of criminal law with its threats to life and liberty, but of civil law, too, insofar as it seeks the enforcement of contracts. Think about that word. Law comes down to the application of force. But what else could we expect in a civilization so deeply invested in Newtonian principles? Force, after all, is the only way to influence a mass, or ultimately change the behavior of a person in the Newtonian universe. Inescapably, law, based on Hobbesian assumptions and coercive mechanisms, disrespects the citizen by assuming that coercion is even needed. Consider a trivial example. A sign that says, no littering, $300 fine, versus a sign that says, keep America beautiful, please don't litter. The first almost implies that if it weren't for the fine, we would want to litter. The fine appears as the reason for not littering. The second comes across as a reminder based on the assumption that the reader certainly does want to keep America beautiful. Or consider an agreement sealed by a handshake. Isn't it a disavowal of trust to insist as well on a financial penalty for breaking it, especially a penalty to be enforced by an outside authority? Is it really deterrence that prevented you from stealing this book from the store? Is your true nature that of wanton acquisition? Or is that kind of behavior the artificial product of the discrete and isolated self, and the painful response to the survival anxiety implemented through our economic and social institutions? Is that really us? Are you really a murderer, if not for the threat of the electric chair? If not, then the laws are insulting. The implicit insult of a deterrence-based or coercion-based legal system is really no different from the other means by which our culture corrals the human spirit and denies its innate goodness, divinity, and creativity. Really, the essential presumption of deterrence is, to use playground language, I'm going to make you do it. How do you make someone do something? By having power over them. And the ultimate power over someone is the power to threaten their survival. The threat to survival implicit in the policeman's gun is little different from that in a parent's shaming. The physical restraint of a jail is little different from that of a parent's superior physical strength. The fact that I am not afraid a policeman will shoot me is beside the point. The fear was internalized and integrated into concepts of propriety, practicality, and prudence long ago. For most people, the gun is just a little reminder of that, a token of an omnipresent threat to survival. It reminds us of the fear that is gonna make us do it. To reform the law along non-coercive lines would be impossible without reforming all the other structures of our society that arise from our conception of self and world. The Hobbesian Calvinist assumption of our inherent selfishness that underlies our legal system and logically necessitates deterrence is actually true, given the conception of self we have today. However, as our current misconception of the self crumbles, a new system of law will arise alongside a new system of economics, technology, and education. Its forerunners are already being tried out in various communities throughout the world. They do not require a society without specialization of labor, villages and tribes where everyone knows each other, but they do draw upon these social forms for inspiration. Such a system of law fosters community rather than short-circuiting it, respects ambiguity and the developmental function of conflict, and most importantly, assumes the goodness and not the depravity of all human beings.
And just to remind you that all of The Ascent of Humanity is now available, including a couple of sections not read out on the air by Lynn. It's available for download from our audiobooks page, unwelcomeguest.net/audiobooks. Now, just to supplement that analysis by Charles Eisenstein, yes, very important to try to encourage people to behave well, which our legal, penal, educational, economic, almost all the centralized systems do not do. My experience as a teacher tells me if you expect the worst from children, then that's a good way to get it. Whilst it's very important to expect the best and try to encourage people to behave well, I think it's also important to note that about 1% of humanity doesn't actually have a conscience. Now, in a local situation, if influence were actually proportional to the numbers, this would be a very small proportion of humanity. But in a hierarchical situation, bearing in mind that the abilities of psychopaths to lie, their selfish focus on achievement, their desire for power over other people, all these character traits predispose them to quickly climb power hierarchies. So the 1% of humanity who don't have a conscience are nevertheless extremely important in terms of shaping most people's perceptions through their control of the media, national governments, commercial institutions. And I think this is a very important frame to bear in mind when we consider the legal system. It is by design a hierarchy, and it claims to be a meritocracy, so that the most worthy, the most capable, in short, the best people are the people at the top. Well, I don't know anybody who believes it actually is a meritocracy. And whilst it's possible to maintain the power of these institutions through force for a short term, I don't think that's stable in the long term. And I think we are witnessing the collapse of these power over hierarchies. As an example of how, despite claims to virtue, privilege of the few is still entrenched in the law, leaving aside issues such as paying for lawyers, which are of course very significant in themselves, consider the case of diplomatic immunity. The Burmese ambassador in Sri Lanka in 1979 shot and killed his wife as she got out of a car after meeting a lover. The next morning, the neighbors noticed the ambassador was stacking wood in his back garden. They called the police because they could see what was happening. The police arrived and he opened the metal gates just wide enough to tell them, "There's no trouble here. Remember, my house is Burmese territory. Sri Lankan laws do not apply." Then he got back to the business of burning his wife in the back garden, and no police action was taken because no laws had been broken. Burmese laws did not apply, and nor did Sri Lankan laws. As a diplomat, he was immune. Now, that was 32 years ago. What's the situation today? Well, I'm reminded of the case of the mercenaries in Iraq, not subject to Iraqi law, who were outside of US law. Did that bother the US officials to have a bunch of adrenaline-pumped, well-armed young things running around getting paid for shooting people up? Apparently not enough to prohibit it or anticipate it. I think the situation's now been fixed, but I wouldn't bet on it. And these dark corners are significant in that they reveal the purpose of the entire system. What's the current situation about diplomatic immunity? Well, it's a hallowed tradition, isn't it? Diplomats are still immune. They're immune from parking restrictions. They're immune from paying charges. The London congestion charge. A lot of people don't like to rent things to diplomats because they can't enforce these contracts. There's been cases of children who've been abused by their parents, diplomats, who are then not liable to prosecution. People have been caught stealing goods and said, look, I'm a diplomat, you can't charge me. People have killed other people. It's not something that commercially controlled media focus on, but it still goes on. The country for whom the diplomat is working has the option to suspend diplomatic immunity, but if you look through the records when this actually occurs, this is very hit and miss, and in my reading of the events, seems to correspond to what you might consider as the global power. So the USA doesn't often do this. It might do for a country like Russia. If it's a small country of negligible importance, then that will be expected to waive the diplomatic immunity if it offends a larger country such as UK, US. So what you might summarize as a pecking order and not codified legally. And now let's return to the more familiar topic of law enforcement, how the law is actually enforced as being anything but impartial, and being another reflection of the same pyramid of privilege which demands people submit to those above them. This is a rebroadcast from episode 177. This is an audiobook that newer listeners will not have heard. Very highly recommended. Disciplined Minds by Jeff Schmidt, about professionalism. Also available from our audiobooks page.
One San Diegan, Edward Lawson, was repeatedly stopped, frisked, and arrested, often violently, solely because of his attitude. Lawson enjoyed walking in pretty residential areas, but as a black man with dreadlocks strolling through wealthy white neighborhoods at odd hours, he would be stopped frequently for questioning by the police. Lawson would demand to know why he was being stopped, but the cops were not interested in giving explanations. When Lawson would press his demand, he often found himself thrown in the back of a squad car with his hands manacled behind him. While Lawson's demand was not illegal, it violated the spirit of the law, which says, "Know your place." Punishment for attitude crimes is rampant today. In California alone, police in 1997 made over 85,000 arrests, in which they released the arrested individuals without filing charges, mainly because of lack of evidence. An even larger number of cases were thrown out by prosecutors before trial. 61% of the individuals given the arrest and release treatment by police were minorities. From employment law to landlord-tenant law to tax law to property law, the spirit of the law is to maintain the privileges of the wealthy. Yet the letter of the law is seemingly neutral on the question. The law and its majestic equality, observed Anatole France, forbids rich and poor alike to sleep under bridges, to beg in the streets, and to steal bread. Nevertheless, those who enforce the law tend to see the wealthy as good guys and tend to be suspicious of people without property. This is not because police are inherently biased people, but because they have to take up the spirit of the law to do a professional job enforcing it. The professional's objective, quote-unquote, enforcement of the law boils down to acting in accord with no ideology other than the one built into the law,
A cop who challenges the law's built-in bias in favor of the status quo would quickly attract the attention of higher-ups. But this is rarely a problem, because the law enforcement professional is tuned more to following orders than to grappling with moral questions. The police officer's legitimate professional questions concern not the nature of the social hierarchy that the law defends, but how best to enforce the law that defends it. Consider the shrink. Many mental problems originate not in diseases of the brain, but in deficiencies of society. The arduousness of living with unfulfilling work, financial insecurity, arbitrary bosses, lack of solidarity, and insufficient personal power, together with the anguish caused by racism, sexism, ageism, lookism, ableism, and all the other oppressive hierarchies that plague this society, helps explain the fact that more than 10% of the population, and not counting those with substance abuse disorders, suffer from mental or emotional problems. There are enough troubled individuals in the United States to keep busy 100,000 psychiatrists and clinical psychologists, and a much larger number of clinically trained social workers and other mental health professionals. People's mental problems often appear as deviations from social or legal norms, and therefore are problems for the status quo as well as for the deviant individuals. The problems of both would be solved if troubled individuals abided by the values of the status quo. And of course, the mainstream mental health system, more often than not, works to alter behavior in that direction. But attempting to adjust people to the unhealthy society that caused their problems in the first place may not always be the healthiest approach for either the individual or society. A simple alternative would be to help some troubled individuals bring out, clarify, and sharpen their implicit critique to strengthen them for the struggle in which they are engaged, instead of removing them from it, because the struggle can be both therapeutic for the individual and beneficial to society. But the institutions of mental health, such as hospitals that employ psychiatrists and clinical psychologists, are institutions of the status quo. They are not about to turn the troubled into troublemakers, no matter how helpful that might be. The mental health professional is someone that such an employer can trust to move confused people away from struggle with social norms and authority and toward a life in which they are, quote, well-adjusted to their place in the socioeconomic hierarchy. As professionals, psychotherapists are, quote, nonpartisan in their work. They just help ill people get better. But to declare extreme nonconformity an illness, as psychology professionals often do, is a partisan act, because of the down-on-the-victim therapeutic framework it rationalizes. Treating sick individuals is a much more politically conservative framework than is treating individuals troubled by a sick and oppressive society. Evidently, it is not the place of the clinicians to question the health of the society in which the patient must be adjusted. Their legitimate professional concern is how best to bring about the adjustment. In this alone, they are expected to use their creativity. The few who do raise questions are seen as getting political, even though it is hard to imagine how they could get any more political than mainstream clinical psychology itself, which often practices conservative social action disguised as medical treatment. And I'm reading from Disciplined Minds, A Critical Look at Salaried Professionals and the Soul-Battering System that Shapes Their Lives by Jeff Schmidt.
Well, I included that last section about medicine as an illustration of how the legal system is intimately connected to all the other centralized, interlocked, oppressive hierarchies which enshrine the top-down model, having a few experts in charge of the many. And of course, many of these experts are qualified more by who they know than what they know. If, for example, a medical school said, no, we are going to work with disturbed people and let them know that society has gone wrong, it's not them who's mad, then I think that would face a lot of legal objections. So I'm not looking for great change from the leaders of these hierarchies. It's possible, and there are good people everywhere. Well, that's one of my personal beliefs. But institutionally, I don't think we can expect a lot. We need people, if we're going to change this mindset, to step out of their institutional framework. Now, as we've seen through all the work on schooling, then people from a very early age are indoctrinated into obedience, and their imagination, their self-determination instincts are bred out of them, as Jeff Schmitt so well documents in his book Disciplined Minds. The professional training process, far from being the politically neutral giving of knowledge needed to do a job, is a social filter and a conversion of marginal cases to people who will support the establishment. Now, as another recent example of how extreme the inequality is, consider surveillance as opposed to suvalence. Suvalence is the opposite. Suvalence is us looking at them. There's equipment you can buy, like a little camera that sits around your neck and records video. And I think you can probably send it live to the internet as well. This is called surveillance equipment. And you wouldn't think doing anything wrong. You are just recording what your eyes see anyway. But apparently this is very offensive to the powers that be, the same powers that be that demand the right to video the populace, and more than just that. Now, this was published on the 19th of September this year by Jonathan Turley, who is a speaker we'll hear at the start of the next hour, speaking about the state's secrets privilege. And the title is Posner Ridicules Right of Citizens to Film Police in Seventh Circuit Oral Argument. And this concerns the American Civil Liberties Union in a case involving the right of citizens to film police in public. And Judge Posner cut off the ACLU lawyer after 14 words and spoke derisively of the right of citizens and groups to engage in such protected conduct, stating, quote, yeah, I know, but I'm not interested, really, in what you want to do with these recordings of people's encounters with the police, unquote. Posner continued, quote, once all this stuff can be recorded, there's going to be a lot more of this snooping around by reporters and bloggers. I'm always suspicious of the civil liberties people start telling the police how to do their business, unquote. But nobody's telling anybody how to do things here. The only threat that such surveillance poses is the threat of sharing with a wider audience what has gone on. So what's the danger for the police and judiciary here? I've got loads of videos of police violence put on YouTube. Police handcuffing people and then kicking them when they're on the ground or punching them in the face. Turley writes, Illinois legislators and prosecutors have taken the lead on fighting the right of citizens to observe and record the conduct of the police. Last month, the U.S. Court of Appeals for the First Circuit handed down the opinion below in the case of Simon Glick, a lawyer who was arrested for filming officers